This is an Equity Bates Media podcast.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Equity Minds.
I will say this about investing. Everything you do learn is cumulative. What I learned at 20 is you can.
Welcome to another episode of Equity Mates, a podcast that follows our journey of investing. Whether you're an absolute beginner or approaching Warren Buffett status, our aim is to help break down your barriers from beginning to dividend. My name is Bryce, and as always, I'm joined by my equity buddy, Ren. How are you going?
I'm very good, Bryce. I'm excited for this interview. We first heard this speaker at ASX Investor Day. We were sitting in the audience, and we thought it was such a good presentation that we've asked him to join us on the podcast, and we want to have the similar discussion again because we thought it deserved to be shared.
That's it. It's our pleasure to welcome to the studio James Holt. James, welcome.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here. Thanks, guys.
So James is a Director of Investment Solutions at Perpetual. And as we've spoken about on the show before, Perpetual is an Australian fund manager and is one of Australia's oldest companies, founded in 1886. Today, we're speaking to James about finding those hidden investment gems amongst all of the noise at the moment: COVID, market falls, inflation, and war. So much going on. We're going to unpack it all. Thank you to Perpetual for supporting and sponsoring this episode as well. You can head to perpetual.com.au to find plenty of information on what they offer. But as Ren said, James, your presentation covered a lot at the ASX Investor Day, and it was fascinating. So we're going to unpack it all. But Ren, first we start with let's start with the investment story.
Yeah. So James, we always like to start with people, the story of people's first investment. We find there's a good story or a good lesson that often comes out of it. So to kick us off today, what was your very first investment?
Look, I'd probably have to say it was Coles Myer, back when it was Coles Myer, back in the day, many, many years ago. And I can't remember if I didn't buy it myself, so to speak. I was either too young or too poor or whatever it was, but I convinced mum to invest, you know. So she bought these Coles Myer shares back in the late 80s, early 90s. And look, I thought they were a good price, and I really liked the company, and you know, there are all sorts of things that went on with Coles Myer back then as well. But I just love this idea of owning a conglomerate that had Coles as the core sort of supermarket. What got mum over the line is that you got a shareholder discount, consumer discount card as well, you know, if you bought the shares. So yes. she was, mum's a very, very smart person, and sort of could get the investment thesis and liked the idea and had the dividend reinvestment plan as well. But that, I think it had all the elements of a great investment, right? Because it didn't sort of shoot the lights out year in, year out. It just sort of steadily grew. Her shares accumulated. The dividends kept on pouring out. It was just a great, great investment.
Nice. Yeah. Well, I don't think they give a discount card to shareholders anymore. So
they cut it out. They cut it out. Yeah.
So James, from that moment to now, you've had plenty of experience in markets. Have you developed an investment philosophy?
Yeah, look, I'd say I'm pretty value-oriented. Having said that, value is not enough in its own right. You know, so you've got to, you know, I don't believe in necessarily, you know, using the value index or buying low price to book. You know, you don't want to own the best buggy whip manufacturer, you know, just before it goes out of business. I bet it was high quality, you know, as they say in that film, Other People's Money. So you want an element of growth or quality as well. You want to have, you need to have a lens over it to make sure you're not buying something that's going to go out of business. So look, I've had a whole lot of learnings. You know, the good times and the bad times never last forever. You know, it's always darkest before the dawn. You know, these are all critical things I've sort of had. This is my third bubble, if you count COVID bubble as a bubble. I've been through tech and I've been through, and you read about them in history books, you know what I mean? You read about the South Sea bubble and the Tulip Mania, and you just think, surely, you know, people could not have been that mad. But it's only when you've been through one. I think the 90s was a critical one. People whip themselves into a frenzy, you know, and that's when you start to pay, you know, you know, growth at any price sort of thing. And so I definitely like to have that sort of value orientation, but I'm always wary of the herds and those sort of things. And, you know, two or three things really matter that can drive a stock. So I think that's where you've also got to be focused. Don't get too bogged down in the minutiae. It's important to cover your tracks and read the annual report and all the details, but often you find within a couple of key decisions, that's when your thesis is there. But generally, you know, it's always said, you know, invest in what you know. I'd take it a step further. Invest how you'd shop. We love to shop for bargains. We like to get a deal. But people sort of almost invest the other way around. They want to pay for things when they're most expensive. You know, that's the experience of bubble mania, right? And instead, if you just sort of, if you're patient, you're steady, you keep a bit of cash on the side, even the best quality stocks at some point will become bargains or an acceptable rate of return, and that's the time to buy them. You know, patience will always win out.
Yeah, well, I think that's a great lead into what we're talking about today, because at the ASX day, your presentation was about finding those hidden investment gems amongst all the noise. And, you know, we talk about stocks being on sale and some stocks are down, you know, 90% plus at the moment. So it's a good time to be looking for those hidden investment gems. And the real starting point for you in your presentation, and I think the starting point for most conversations about investing and financial markets these days, is inflation. Is it transitory? Is it structural? What's going on? Is there a new normal? And that leads into interest rates. So let's start there. We've had 2021 where transitory was the word, and 2022, that word has sort of dropped out of our lexicon a little bit. Where's your head at and where's Perpetual's head at about inflation at the moment?
So right, Alec. And also remember, we had transitory for longer as well. Don't remember that? Which is one of the great, you know, so we had transitory. And I guess, look, our journey here and was really begun with talking to CEOs. One of the great advantages of, you know, having we do a lot of investments with Perpetual, you know, primarily a stock picking house. And we talked to hundreds and hundreds of CEOs and CFOs and all the people in the business. And it was very clear early on that there was something, you know, quite serious on the inflation front coming through. And I think it was Woolworths who sort of said, you know, normally look, out of 10 items, they can normally manage the, you know, there might be one or two that are a bit inflationary, but they can sort of spread the inflation through the system and keep prices low and so forth and sort of manage it that way. But instead, they had 80 to 90% of all items going up in price. There was price pressures. And remember, there's two elements, obviously. There's the demand element. So there was massive stimulus, you know, and in hindsight, clearly the stimulus was too much. And Larry Summers in the US sort of talked about that. I think we manage it pretty well here, but of course, everything emanates from the US. So when the US overstimulated to the extent that it did, that sort of ripple effect came across here as well. And in fact, you know, everything we've had has just been a few months behind the US. So we were shocked when the US hit 7-8% inflation. It's not going to happen here. It did. It has. It's just taken a bit longer to get here, right? Mm. And the other side of it, of course, is supply side driven as well. So at first blanch, you'd say, well, look, it does seem transitory, and eventually they'll build enough container ships and the container ships will be better organized, and, you know, the big surge in demand will come back to earth again. So an element of it is transitory. There's no doubt about it. Some things will come back to earth again and it won't be a problem. However, the last 30 years, you've got to ask yourself, I did study economics and economic history a bit as well, which I think was very good to sort of put things into perspective. And that is that, is the last 30 years, is that normal, or was that just sort of a lucky, you know, benefit of history that we kind of lived through? Because if you go back the last 200 or 300 years, the last 30 years looks really abnormal, you know. And in fact, we often have inflationary periods, and we often have periods where there's a lot of dislocation and whatever. So there's definitely a transitory element. The thing we do sort of worry about is that, you know, is there sort of this more sustained inflation coming out of it? And things like the trade war or deglobalization, the last time we had it, it went on for 30 years, 1914 to 1945, you know. So the best intentions to kind of fix it in the 1920s, 1930s just didn't occur. The war, it'll be next thing you know, you're sort of off to the races and you just can't fix it up. We've had actual war. We don't know how long it's going to last in Ukraine, you know. It could, people, some people want it to end at the end of this year and are hopeful of that. But as we know, you know, 3 months, 6 months wars are not that common. They usually go on for a bit longer and it might drag on for 2 years. That's a problem. Not just energy, but wheat, getting grains out. You know, a government's, you know, will they reach for, the one thing about the stimulus was, hell, it was effective, wasn't it? Remember how hopeless the post-GFC stimulus was? It took years to get traction. So maybe that's more effective. You then get follow-on inflation into rents and things like that. That's still yet to occur. And look, one thing I was interested in is that there is data out of the IMF that was published many years ago that showed that aging can be inflationary or disinflationary. And we've just had, ironically, the last 30 years, the deflationory aspect of it. And what they're talking about is the population cohort of baby boomers. They're in exactly the right place at exactly the right time. You know, they entered their 20s and 30s and the 70s. They contributed to low inflation from that era onwards. They're now retiring and they're drawing down on that titanic amount of savings they've built up. And if you model it all up, and the IMF modeled it, we should have more inflation for the next couple of decades, you know. So maybe we can't control it. Maybe that's sort of the benefit we got. And the last thing is just inflationary expectations. You know, that's the big worry. So again, you know, you'll hear me talk about anchoring a lot from time to time because people get anchored on things. They get at the last 5 years, 10 years, whatever, that becomes a new normal. That's where you get the term, you know, house prices never fall, because if they haven't fallen for 5 years, people think that's expected. And inflation's the same. If they see inflation for 1, 2, 3 years, next thing they expect it. And that's suddenly what the central banks have said they're worried about. But that is something certainly to be fearful of, that people expect it. They bake it in, they make these massive wage claims, you get this wage price spiral coming out at the end.
There's a lot of factors there that you touched on, and you know, some that are spoken about a lot, the stimulus and the war in Ukraine. But I think some of those that are not discussed as much, you mentioned demographics and the cost of healthcare, and that, I guess, moving from a saving and investing mindset to a spending mindset in retirement for baby boomers. Another one that you talked about in your presentation was decarbonisation, which I thought was really interesting because, you know, from an investing lens, we're all hearing so much about ESG and all of that, but people don't often think about the inflation impacts of some of these new technologies and new changes and stuff like that. So do you want to just quickly explain the link between decarbonisation and potential inflation?
Yeah, and you know, in the long term, you know, as Keynes said, in the long term we're all dead, of course, but in the long term, you know, maybe the inflation sort of comes out of the system again. And I think when you actually go through the process of putting everything in place, it does. But in the short to medium term, it's hard to see how it's not inflationary. And in fact, that you'll see it won't take long to find literature out there talking about this as a problem, right? Because do you impose a carbon tax, which is instantly inflationary? You know, if in Europe, if you applied, you know, their sort of carbon pricing to cement, for example, the price of cement goes up by about 70% or thereabouts. Carbon's everywhere. You know, that's the thing. We're even based on carbon, you know, as humans. So there's carbon out there. How do you do it? Do you impose a tax? Do you do the investment? Germany has spent, I think, $750 billion on renewables, and their price of energy is about 50% higher than us, double of the US. So I should say as well, I think it's laudable. It's a laudable goal to decarbonize. You know, I think we should, but I think the critical thing is we've probably got to accept that it will cost more, certainly in the short to medium term, before you get the benefits of it. And also, look, at the time when we're drawing down on capital, you know, accumulated savings, the amount to be invested in decarbonisation is again, mammoth. You know, it is many, many tens of trillions of dollars. So you think about, again, if you think about the long-term trajectory for interest rates, you know, we've had for this long period this massive savings pool coming out of Asia as it entered the world economy. We've had the baby boomers in the market earning. But as those things change, maybe we don't have the same trade relationships. We have the boomers retire, you know, and have interest rates at really low levels. I mean, seems a bit too good to be true, doesn't it? You know, and so you'd think that that would put some pressure on inflation rates to do it. So I think laudable goal, but I think also we've probably got to be realistic about the cost, certainly in the next few years as it gets implemented. And lastly, one thing we're dealing with is that the demand for nickel, you know, we're very heavily invested in green metals because we think they'll benefit from the electrification of cars and things like that. But if you add up the total amounts required to make all the cars, it's just, again, it's off the scale, you know, and there won't be enough, and that'll create its own inflation and so on as well.
James, I just want to touch on central banks because it's safe to say that they've got it pretty wrong, you would say. The RBA here in Australia said they're not going to they weren't going to raise rates until 2024. And they've come out and said, look, I think we got that call wrong. And Jerome Powell over in the States has similarly said the same thing, that they probably have got the call that inflation was transitory and now it certainly feels like it's here to stay. At Perpetual, what are your views on the response from central banks at the moment? Do you think they're doing enough? Do you feel that the response is adequate? Do you give much weighting to the commentary that they are sending out at the moment? What's the view from Perpetual?
Yeah, we certainly, it's a tough job. You know, it really is a hard job. And I think we do, you know, the pivot they've made towards realizing that, you know, the forecast, I think, you know, Dr. Lowe said the forecasts were pretty poor. They certainly were. And he's fronted up around that, you know, you can say that again. But, you know, it is a tough job and it is hard to get these sort of things right. Look, I think they're really very data dependent as well. And they're also, I think the Fed and the Reserve Bank are in very different positions, where the Fed clearly is tightening and there's a feeling that the Fed will actually head into recession and they might be ahead of the curve compared to us. That is certainly something I think. So you may see, and the Fed's more activist, right? So they'll tend to hike rates very quickly. And then at some point in the next 6-12 months, as it's clear there might be a recession coming, if that starts to show up in jobs data, they've made it, you know, pretty clear that they'll start cutting again. That's certainly the expectation. And so you may see this sort of funny position of we've got to hike them before we have to cut them again. Yeah. So that's just one of those things. The Reserve Bank, we could be in a different position because everyone's focused on two things, right? They're focused on the fact that there's so much accumulated savings. You know, we've got 250, 280 billion of savings accumulated, which is massive firepower, even though consumer confidence is starting to get dented. The job situation is very good. But I think the one thing we have here in Australia is the terms of trade, the China story. And China's been on a different path. Clearly, they've been doing different things. They're doing, you know, they're still pursuing COVID zero. They're trying to, you know, tame their property market. It's a pretty messy thing. But you've got to ask yourself, and the reason this is so important is because for the last 20 years, they've been our get out of jail card. You know, we should have had a couple of recessions in the last 20 years. We overtook the Netherlands and had the longest track record of never having a recession, 29 years. Then COVID struck. But of course, everyone's in recession. You can't help but fall into recession then. But if in the situation before that, what we found was we were probably having domestic recessions, but we kept on getting our external position bailed out by China. So you may find, and nobody can forecast this for sure, but don't be surprised if, say, the Fed's hiking rates, then they're cutting them again. We're hiking rates, maybe a little bit behind the Fed to try and keep up. But then you know what? We aren't forced into cutting. Because if the Fed, you know, the US has a recession, but if China recovers, there's no guarantee we have a recession as well. That's not, you know, that's not baked into the stars. That's something still to be determined. And I only say that because it's happened so many times before. We know China's in a slump. If COVID goes endemic, if they declare an end to the pandemic, there's no more COVID zero required and whatever, you know, China could come out of this, out of the stocks booming, you know, in the latter half of this year or next year, who knows? But I think the Reserve Bank and the Fed are in very different positions. And usually the Reserve Bank tends to raise rates, stay pat for a bit, then raise rates again, stay pat. So we could be doing the raising, but not necessarily the cutting, maybe even, you know, who knows, a bit more hiking potentially as well.
So James, inflation was transitory, then it was structural, and then inflation expectations start to rise, bond yields increase as a result. Interest rates start to get raised, growth stocks sell off, crypto sells off, NFTs tank. And then that goes to the broader stock market. And that's sort of where we're at now. I guess, where does this all go from here? Where do things settle? I know these are big questions. And the ultimate question that every millennial wants to ask, does this sell-off in assets extend to housing? But let's put a pin in housing for now, and let's talk about interest rates in the stock market. Where do you think interest rates settles? Where do you think the stock market settles? What's your sort of short to medium term outlook?
It's worth noting as well, just backing up a little bit, that the bond market's right 9 times out of 10, you know, compared to equities. And so there was that signal that bonds were, you know, equities were really sanguine and, you know, a bit, you know, very optimistic all the time, whereas bonds sort of rose up very quickly, put that pin into equities. We did see, I think, if you look at what's happened, the small cap sector's been hit hardest, both in the US and Australia. So you think about, you know, all those meme stocks that Jim Cramer sort of talked about last year. They're all down 90%, right? Mm. They've all been napalmed. And the same in Australia. The Zips and the Sezzles of the world are all down, you know, 90-95% or thereabouts. So they've been hit very hard. We refer to them as concept stocks. And, you know, again, the concept is fine. You've just got to have cash at some point, especially when the price of money is really, really rocketing through the roof. And I think the bond market really called out all this stuff because, you know, Australian bonds, 10-year bonds hit 4.2% or thereabouts, I think, or 4.15. So that's, if you look at the last, that's a dramatic break with the trend over the last couple of decades. So clearly the bonds sort of signal there's something different here about inflation in the system, which they kind of wanted to speak about. I think Jim Cramer's even said that equities, he's always got a great turn of phrase, said equities are being held hostage by bonds at the moment, you know, so. James Carville once said in the US that, you know, he wants to come back as the bond market because he can rule the world, you know, because it sort of drives every other bit of activity in the global system. So look, definitely speared. The small cap sector's been hit. Large caps have been a little bit hit, but not too bad. So, you know, if you think about that meme complex hit first, the FANG stocks primarily, you know, a little bit of it, you know, Facebook got hit, obviously, Netflix got hit, but then the others have, you know, sagged a bit, but they're not too bad, you know. So is there more room for them to decline? And again, I think we've got to think about these in a couple of different ways. First of all, a PE of 25, 30, it's not like a PE of 100, but if the market decides it wants to put everything on a PE of 10 to 15 times, there's still a lot of room to fall, right? You know, that's number one. Number two, with a lot of these stocks, you've got to look at the scale of the earnings. So a $2 trillion stock that's on a P of 20, it's earning $100 billion NPAT per annum. That's, and it's in tech, where every year there's a new tech company out to gouge that company and grab market share and put it in the dustbin of history. Tech companies live a lot shorter lives generally than other companies, right? I know they're kind of monopolies, a lot of things, and that's an argument as well. But you know, we've seen many of these companies drop through history. You know, Sears Roebuck was invincible once. Now it's bankrupt. You know, dominant handset device makers, you know, ruled the roost. You know, think of Nokia, then they're gone. BlackBerry gone. So just because you've got a massive market share and you appear to have a monopoly doesn't mean it's going to be guaranteed. And if you've got a $100 billion NPAT a year company, for the next 10 years, they're going to make $1 trillion worth of NPAT. In the face of competition, new technology, regulators, that's a big ask, isn't it? You know what I mean? So that's where I think, you know, we have seen Netflix and Facebook affected, and the others don't seem to be as badly affected, but that could still happen to them. So I think you got to keep an eye on how big the NPAT is and how big a target that is, and therefore that might be vulnerable at some point. And then you turn to Australia, the same sort of thing here. So the small caps have been hit, the big caps have been unaffected. And if you look through time, what tends to happen is, and look, we love CSL. We think CSL is a fantastic company. It's a bit too expensive for us. And it's on 30, 35, 38 times. That's a big price for a big company that grows pretty slowly, no matter how high quality it is. And again, if you flip that PE of 35 times around, what is it? That's a earnings yield of 3%. Well, the bond market's paying you 4. Mm. So what, on top of the 3% earnings yield, what extra equity risk premium do you put on top of a CSL? Should it be 2%, 2.5%, 1.5%, whatever? So you've got to say, well, here's a company that's an equity that people are putting less risk on than the bond market itself, sovereign bonds, in terms of the equity risk premium. Again, it doesn't make sense. So look, it may never happen. Nothing may ever happen. That may never correct, right? But CSL has corrected previously in history, a very different company sort of 20 years ago. It did fall quite significantly. And people were very excited. I remember people being very excited about it in 2001, 2003. Then it got cut very severely before it recovered, bought out a competitor and regained its place. But that's not to say it can't happen again. Or the other thing that happens is that you may not collapse. You may not have the 50, 30, 40, 60% share correction, whatever it is. But you know what? You get stuck in what they call the Woolworths position of many years ago, which is that Woolworths just went nowhere for nearly a decade from 2007 to 2013, 14. It just stayed at the same price and it grew into its earnings. And the same thing happened to Microsoft before. So Microsoft actually fell 75% from 2000 to 2009. So it did actually fall, but then it didn't get back to where it was until 2015 or 16 or 17, back into the 2000 level. And look at Cisco. This Cisco has never traded, I think, still above where it was in 2000. So it's not so much the, you get really expensive, you get either crash in price, or you just go sideways for years. And that becomes a problem for investors. So again, you're almost being better off being invested almost anywhere else. Anything that generates a real return to give you, real return you need to get out of there again.
So, James, before we take a quick break and then turn our attention to finding gems in this environment, it's a good place to have a quick chat about housing. There's been plenty of discussion that we're now starting to see it cool. We've seen some of the bubbliest markets around the world start to come off as well, and Australia is always lumped in that heap of one of the hottest property markets in the world. So with NFTs down, crypto down, growth assets hit, interest rates rising, inflation, now at a point where it feels like it's here to stay, what's your view on housing and where to from here for that asset class?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. I think we will have a reasonable correction in house prices. So that'll decline sort of, I think the forecasts that are out there sort of, 10, 15, 20% are pretty on the money. It might be a case of 10% one year, 5% the next, or 5 and 10 or whatever. We'll wind up in that 15 to 20% correction zone. They've had a very good run. Same thing is going on in the US. I remember the US housing bubble 03 to 07. They've had the same thing again, but it only took one year to get there. So it's a global phenomenon. It's hit us pretty hard here as well in terms of rising valuations. It'll come down the other side. Look, I think the actual quantum of correction is less important than the impact it'll have. It'll definitely have an impact on consumption. I mean, most people don't have their money in the stock market. Most average people, punters, have their money in the housing market. So the impact of correction in house prices, there's been lots of studies, it has sort of 2 to 3 times the impact of a correction in the stock market. So that will certainly hit things. The question will be, does the $280 billion in cash, which is roughly 10% of GDP, 15% of GDP, does that offset the kind of negative housing correction? Does the super strong jobs market, does that offset it as well to a degree? Does it occur in 1 year or 2 years? If it occurred in 1 year, I think we'd be in trouble, right? But if it probably spread over 2 years, it may be more absorbable. And I think, again, if you look back at a few rough periods like 2012, 13, the GFC period itself, we had stimulus during the GFC, but the real thing that got us out of trouble was, again, the China recovery, So again, so much swings on that sort of external environment, which is why I think people are quite ready to call the likelihood of a US recession, and people are talking 70, 80% probability. I'd put that much lower in Australia. I think it'll be a painful period. Consumers will feel it, but we may have one of those periods again where GDP actually stays positive. Consumers feel a pretty nasty sort of run, but they don't necessarily, doesn't translate into negative GDP. Worth noting as well that in the tech wreck in 2000, The US market fell, I think, 43%, you know, if you include September 11 as well. We didn't even have a correction here.
Mm.
We actually didn't have a correction. So I think, in fact, it only fell by single digits in total. And you look earlier this year, remember the US stock market fell quite dramatically. NASDAQ was down. Our market nearly didn't fall nearly as much. We've had a bit of a fall in recent weeks. Mm. It's sort of caught up with us a little bit. But again, because our tech sector is not 25, 27%, like the US is only about 3%. You know, it's pretty small. We're like a giant, Australia's like a giant hedge fund in a way, you know, like it's sort of in a good way, I mean, because, you know, if you think about how well balanced the market is, if the global economy booms or China booms, iron ore takes off, and that leaves the BHPs and the Rios going. If the world goes to hell, we've got huge gold stocks here in Australia that also benefit, you know, and we've got a decent share of financials and consumer stocks to balance it out as well. Whereas I think the challenge in the US has been that tech sector has become bigger and bigger and bigger over time, and it is prone to these periods of overvaluation as well as correction. So I think that's okay. On crypto, and I didn't mention that before. Sorry, Bryce, you did mention it. But look, I understand what they're trying to do. I can actually even understand the whole attraction of deregulated currency and digital currency and so on and so forth. What I've never really gotten, though, is that if you can make 20,000 currencies or 50,000 currencies or 100,000 currencies, how can they all be really valuable? And secondly, why would governments ever want them to succeed? Because most of these currencies, of course, 70 or 80% of them are retained by their originators, right, and the owners. So, I think the central banks have got problems. The alternative to handing over, you know, multi-trillion-dollar worth to all these crypto people around the world who are not in the purview of government or regulators or anything like that, that just doesn't seem at all sane, right? So I think that was a logic. And even a tech guy told me, you know, look, remember, our capitalism, which I'm a strong believer in, the great thing about it is it's about necessities in search for invention, right? That's what drives capitalism. We need something. Someone goes out and makes it and happy days. Crypto feels like an invention in search of a necessity. You know what I mean? It's almost the reverse way around. And that's usually a problem. So I think when we've got other digital currencies and other digital forms of transaction, everyone was kind of scratching our heads as to what was the new special need being solved here. There didn't seem to be one.
Well, James, there's a whole other podcast we could do on crypto, but let's stick with stocks today. We've really covered the macro, you know, the inflation and the interest rate environment and what we're sort of living through at the moment. We're going to take a quick break, and then on the other side of it, we really want to get into the stock specific stuff. We want to talk about how we can find those hidden investment gems. So we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back to talk about that.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So, James, before the break, we spoke a lot about what's going on in the macro environment. We have inflation, we have rising interest rates, except in Japan, they're holding out. But the majority of the world is raising rates, and the majority of markets are down in 2022. But that creates an opportunity for investors, for those that are willing to be greedy when others are fearful. There might be some opportunities. And so that's what we really want to pick your brain about in the second half of this episode. And I guess the starting point for us, in your ASX Day presentation, you shared a number of categories which Perpetual, I guess, are finding interesting at the moment. Can you sort of use them as signposts to talk about a few stocks that you think might be some of those hidden gems. So the first was stocks that are going to benefit because food and energy inflation are likely to persist. And there was one company that you called out in your presentation, Santos. Do you want to talk about why you think that's an interesting category and then why Santos over, you know, a Woodside or some of the other resource or energy plays that are available?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. So, the theme itself, sort of food and energy, you know, clearly they were sort of clear targets for inflation. We've held a lot of things over the years, the grain corps of the world. We've held, Incitec Pivot as well, which was, more or less sold most of recently. People, during dry periods, a lot of those stocks go begging, and that's a good time to buy. And then the wet comes, and people need fertilizer. They want to plant crops. The crops go, the harvests are fantastic and whatever. So you tend to get a great sort of lift on that. Santos is probably one we're most excited about now, and is a very big position in a lot of our portfolios. So I think there's probably, a couple of things here. Obviously, there's been a merger with Oil Search. It's primarily a gas producer with big assets in Papua New Guinea. Gas is a key transition energy. It has less emissions than oil. And over time, as we do see this sort of shift, we can't make the shift overnight to renewables. Even if you get the windmills and the solar panels right, and they're getting there, you've also got to store the energy. So gas will always be a kind of a transitional energy for a long period of time. There'll always be some gas around. Gas can also be switched on and off too, unlike coal. We've got to keep the coal sort of turning over all the time, which is one thing that people point to as well. Having said that as well, they do have carbon capture and storage facilities as well, which sort of helps to get to reduce their carbon footprint as well. So strong balance sheet, gearing ratio of about 26%. So clearly benefiting from the tightness in energy markets. Europe wants to import more gas. We think they'll benefit from that. Ongoing disruptions, obviously. And also critically for us, asset sell downs. So look, one thing that's sort of held the stock back a bit is that this is a nice problem to have. Have they got too many projects? Have they got so many assets they've got to exploit? Are they going to struggle to kind of develop them all? So do they sell one of them? Do they sell down? They've got a 42.5% stake in PNG, LNG. Do they sell part of that? They've got a stake in other projects in WA. Do they sell a bit of that? They got another project in Alaska. Do they sell a bit of that? So look, our expectation is they would, sell roughly $2 to $3 billion worth of assets, and that would reduce their gearing again. That would give them cash, would see more cash flow, the ability to pay higher dividends and things like that, and also reduce the burden of their CapEx expenditure. So I think the asset's good. You think about the two or three things that drove a stock, right? The assets are good. The company's in a very good position. They've got options as far as what they can do. There is a catalyst you can see there via the asset sell downs to kind of re-rate the stock upwards from where it is.
Another, I guess, area or thematic where we're able to find some gems, James, is in green metals. So zinc, copper, cobalt, I guess, maybe one.
Yeah.
Zinc and copper. Yeah. Why is this area still attractive for you?
The demand ongoing is going to be absolutely enormous. You think about the electrification of vehicles, we're still, I think, only 2% of cars are electrified. So that's a good growth market for you right there. Right? It's going to go ahead for a long, long, long period of time. Mm. And all the forecasts we see are that basically market will struggle to keep up with the demand required for those commodities. So one, for example, is Jervois, which is listed in Australia, and we first started buying that in 2021. It's been entered into the FTSE World Index earlier this year, and also into the ASX 300 Index as well. So it does get a bit more coverage now than it did before. Cobalt and nickel are key assets there. One thing, obviously, that is that they've got a cobalt mine in the US. They've also got one, a refinery in Finland. So, you think about one issue with cobalt is that people don't like where cobalt is mined currently in some unsavory parts of the world. So this provides an option that's outside of it. it's mined in a more sustainable part of the world, and I think that looks very attractive to us long term. Also, Iluka, I think, is the other one that's very attractive in that space. So, look, they've got, you know, they spun off their Datura royalty, which we also have owned as well. So, which was an iron ore royalty and didn't quite fit as well with them. Rutile and zircon, biggest producer in the world. But also, the other big thing with Iluka is that it's expanding into rare earths. And again, this is one of those things, along with those other commodities you mentioned that we need. And at the moment, China has the vast majority of rare earths in the world, which has obviously been raised eyebrows in the sort of post COVID era. They're actually spending $1.2 billion on a refinery near Perth. It's got federal government support as well. Clearly, there's a desire to have these sort of critical assets, these sort of critical green metals being manufactured in other parts of the world. And so these sort of stocks are key beneficiaries of that trend.
It is a fascinating space, James. We are running out of time, and I do want to ask about a couple of stocks that are of less interest, including one that definitely gets tongues wagging in the Equity Mates community. So I'll just quickly list the other categories that you spoke about in your presentation. Business models with interest rates as tailwinds, and IAG was an example there. Spending on experiences as, you know, everything sort of reopens. Qantas and Event Hospitality and Entertainment were two companies mentioned there. And then founder-led stocks, Premier Investment was an example there. But let's get to stocks of less interest. And you mentioned concept stocks earlier. They're not of interest now, according to your presentation, even though some are down 80 to 90%. And you mentioned Zip there, and Zip is the company that probably gets the most discussion in the Equity Mates community. Do they ever become interesting again? Like, is there a point where you start to look at maybe not Zip or Sezzle, but some of those concept stocks and start to say it makes sense?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a great question. I think, you know, that particular place, because you make a lot of money if you get it right. You know, let's face it, alongside all the you know, the Enrons and the WorldComs, Amazon was down 90% at one point, maybe even more, you know, and recovered and made a fortune for people. And there are plenty of stocks in that space. But I think if you look at but then again, we've also had the One Tills, right, as well in Australia, and you know, went to God along with Davnet and a few others. So look, I would say we really require kind of proof of earnings for it to become interesting to us. So we do have, and it's probably been mentioned before by Vince and Nathan, but we do have four quality filters. So debt has got to be fairly low, and he's got to be able to cover it to a reasonable degree. Recurring earnings, quality of business, quality of industry. And most of those stocks fail almost all those filters, right?
Because they may have
a wonderful entrepreneur at the head, but where's the recurring earnings? Where's the cash to cover debt? And are they in a quality industry, or are they in a good position in an industry, a quality business in a good industry? And that's the number one problem you've got. And then in the buy now, pay later space, I think the big challenge will not be return on your money. It'll be return of your money, because if we do have consumers go into struggle in the next couple of years, you think about, I said we would avoid a recession, I think, I hope, but that doesn't mean we don't have a domestic recession, and consumers might really, really struggle. And then if you have massive, massive defaults, and we're talking about non-performing loans, you know, about half of them potentially, for some of those buy now, pay later stocks, where do they go from there? Because also the trap that often occurs is that in the last 5 years, can you raise money from the equity market? Yep, so easy. Just go to the market. People are going to throw money at it. Can they go to the bank? Maybe not so now. But once the bank closes and the equity market closes to them, there's nowhere to go. Mm. And that's why they tend to fail. So not making predictions are obviously, but that's the struggle. That is the real struggle with a lot of these companies. And in the US, the one thing going on, the one place where jobs aren't being created, if you go back, the number of people being laid off at tech firms is skyrocketing, because they've all been told, if we don't make money in the next 12 months, we're done. And so that will be the struggle for any surviving stocks here in Australia as well in that space.
Fascinating times, James. But unfortunately, we have run out of time. We'll definitely have to get you back on the show, though, to continue the discussion as things change in markets over the next few months. If our community have enjoyed listening, if you have enjoyed listening to James, he will be speaking at our FinFest event in October with Perpetual there as well. So we're incredibly excited for that. But James, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure. We thoroughly enjoyed your presentation at the ASX Investor Day as much as I really took a lot out of this conversation with you today, as I'm sure a lot of our community did as well. So thank you so much.
Absolutely loved it, guys. Wonderful.
Thanks, James.
Equity Mates Investing Podcast is a product of Equity Mates Media. All information in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. Equity Mates gives listeners access to information and educational content provided by a range of financial service professionals. It is not intended as a substitute for professional finance, legal, or tax advice. The hosts of Equity Mates Investing Podcast are not financial professionals and are not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Equity Mates Media does not operate under an Australian Financial Services License and relies on the exemption available under the Corporations Act 2001 in respect of any information or advice given. Before making any financial decisions, you should read the product disclosure statement and, if necessary, consult a licensed financial professional. Do not take financial advice from a podcast or video. For more information, head to the disclaimer page on the Equity Mates website, where you can find ASIC resources and find a registered financial professional near you. In the spirit of reconciliation, Equity Mates Media and the hosts of Equity Mates Investing Podcast acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.